on the Apostle Paul's second missionary journey.
Paul's second missionary journey. It's covered in Acts 15:36 through 18:22. Let's take a look at a map of the second journey. As you can see, this covers more distance than his first journey. It will take him across Asia Minor, up across into Greece, through the Grecian Peninsula, back to the Asian Minor city of Ephesus, back to Caesarea, and back to Antioch. All of Paul's journeys are reckoned as starting and finishing in Antioch. In Paul's first journey, as you heard from Brother Brian, John Mark accompanied Paul. But John Mark failed to complete that missionary journey with the others, as he left only partway through the trip. This becomes an issue for who will go with Paul on the second journey. There is significant disagreement between Barnabas and Paul on including John Mark or not. And since they can't seem to resolve it, they thus split up into two teams, as it were, one consisting of Barnabas and Mark, and another consisting of Paul and Silas. So with the personnel and the general direction into Asia Minor decided, the trip begins heading north along the coast from Antioch of Syria. Pardon me, wrong button. There we go. From Antioch of Syria and then across Asia Minor to the west once they pass the corner of the sea. And we'll be using this map. It's a little more, you're able to see the cities a little more clearly on this one, but it's geographically tilted to the left there for you. They first passed through Derbe, where Paul had gone on his first journey, but the scriptures only note the city without recording any of the events there. However, up the road in Lystra, and that was also covered in the first journey, we are introduced to Timothy, son of a Jewish mother and a Greek father, with whom Paul becomes very close. With the addition of Timothy to the party, the issue of circumcision amongst Gentile converts could have come to the forefront. The issue had been debated for the most part and was decided at Jerusalem, but to avoid it becoming a distraction in the further dissemination of the gospel as Paul preached in these journeys, Paul instead has Timothy circumcised at this point. Let's take a look at Acts 16, 6, and 9, and 10. As they pass through the Phrygian and Galatian region, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night, and a certain man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him, saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." And when he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. Paul's journey had almost exclusively been contained in the Asia Minor Peninsula and the island of Cyprus. But apparently here at the city of Antioch in Asia Minor, circumstances soon made it apparent to Paul and his companions that the gospel was now to be preached in new territories. And as Pastor Russell entitled an article concerning this in 2175, the gospel was to be sent to Europe. Undoubtedly, the story and reputation of Christianity had spread in the 10 to 15 years after Jesus' crucifixion to this part of the world, that being Eastern Europe. But this vision in verse 10 was an unmistakable indication that the Lord intended to cultivate fledgling churches here and to the west. Brother Russell recognizes this incident as an instrumental point that would set the direction for the spread of the gospel throughout the entire age. Appropriate is clear from the account that the group was not deciding on their own what should be the next stop, but they were instead earnestly seeking the Lord's will in the matter. As human nature is both an intellectual and heartfelt experience, so would be the distribution and the appreciation of the gospel message. The Lord recognized where intellectual development was excelling, and at this point in time, it was clearly north and west of the Holy Land, toward Europe, and eventually, in the latter stages of the gospel age, to the western continents and the west and the north and South America. Thus, it was Paul's decision to follow the pleading of the vision for help. Greek literature and study of the physical sciences at this time was still in high repute, even in light of the Roman conquest and extension of this Greek empire. The first stop in Macedonia was a city of Philippi, one of the larger principal cities of the region. Paul discoursed here to an audience of predominantly Jewish women, among whom was Lydia, the seller of purple. And after it, Lydia requested that Paul and his companions stay at her house. The concept of Christian entertainment and hospitality is thus established for the entire Gospel Age church. Next, in verses 17 and 18 of Acts 16, is the account of the possessed girl that followed the group, constantly shouting that they were indeed servants of the Most High God and were proclaiming the way unto salvation. Let's look at that scripture in Acts 16, verses 17 and 18. Following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, "These are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." And she continued doing this for many days. But Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out at that very moment. Paul, in verse 17, is clearly annoyed by this, even though, in fact, what we read that the girl was proclaiming what was, in fact, true. There is a lesson for us in Paul's reaction. We might be inclined to take comfort and support anywhere we can find it, reasoning that the Lord may be providing those means. Paul, though, objected not to the message, but to the source. Clearly, he saw the source as not from the Lord, but quite the opposite, from the adversary. And we must evaluate any source or help or assistance as proper in the Lord's sight when evaluating the source from which it came. Let's move on to verse 19, also in chapter 16. But when her masters saw that the hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. And when they had brought them to the chief magistrates, they said, "These men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews, and are proclaiming customs which is not lawful for us to accept or to observe, being Romans." They were not accused of, in this incident of casting out of the demons, they were accused of being Jews. Apparently, casting out of a revenue-producing evil spirit was not contrary to Roman law at that time. The pair was thrown into prison after being publicly beaten. Verse 25 tells us that as the evening hours pass, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns. In reprint 2181, Brother Russell spends a lot of time expanding on this. We won't have time to even quote you a short section of it, but he emphasizes how important and unique the singing of hymns had been to the Jews and would continue to be in the Christian church. It was the custom of most others at that time to moan in sorrowful tones in such circumstances. But heart-uplifting singing was used by Jews, and would likewise, that would be the practice of the Christian church going forth. It seems that this circumstance, a witness to the jailer, required more extraordinary circumstances. The jailer clearly had a strong commitment to job and responsibility. But a strong earthquake, badly damaging the prison, literally freed all or most of the prisoners and had the jailer poised to take his own life, expecting that Paul and Silas had also escaped. And he had failed. At least that's what he assumed. What prisoner would not jump at the chance to escape prison as the prison literally crumbled around him? Surely Paul and Silas were gone. Now, put yourself in Paul's shoes. If you are imprisoned, if I was imprisoned, I think I would have been off like a shot when I saw that hole in the wall, figuring that the Lord had provided a special, miraculous deliverance for me. And maybe Paul had to put his hand on the younger Silas at that time and keep him from fleeing, because Paul realized that had the Lord not intended them for to be in prison and to escape this way, he would have overruled the situation so they wouldn't have been in prison in the first place. No, they were children of God in an age of faith, not of sight, and thus not in need of such a spectacular deliverance. Paul surely reasoned that they, again, that this could have been overruled by the Lord had that been his will. But this experience was necessary for one of much less faith to see the truth, for it was for the sake of a witness to their jailer. The jailer immediately saw his need of salvation and in and through the character of these prisoners, in that they saw their mission and their commitment to the cause clearly above their own freedom. The jailer was converted and subsequently entertained the brethren in his home, and are likely relating the experiences of this to the town magistrates, and thus they had the pair released. Now, you might think that this triumphant exit from the prison and the prospects of continued ministry throughout Greece would be enough for Paul and the local brethren. But Paul saw an opportunity to further the jailer's opportunity for continued witnessing even after their departure. It was not at their arrest, but at this time that Paul brought out to the attention of the town officials that they were indeed Roman, and this local government had not given them the rights that they were entitled to. He insisted that the magistrates come in person to the prison and publicly declare their release and likely publicly apologize to them for their treatment. Clearly, this put them on notice that Paul had the leverage and that their jailer, as well as Lydia and their families, their Christian converted families, should not be hindered in their efforts to witness further. Paul used his Roman citizenship here not for his personal advantage, but held it in reserve for when it would further the message of the gospel. Another good lesson for the church now in thinking and evaluating how to use our talents and our resources. It appears that the potential for Philippi is so great that they leave Luke at this city while Paul, Silas, and Timothy continue to the west. We now move to chapter 17, traveling west from Philippi. That's over here on the map, and this is west, even though it's kind of downward. Traveling west from Philippi along the southern coast of Macedonia, Paul's company traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, of which we have no account of the issues there until he reaches Thessalonica. Thessalonica had a large synagogue, and Paul, as he did in almost every other instance, witnessed first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. Both were in general very receptive to the message he put forth. But as so often was the case, response of the Jews was less than response from the Greeks. In Thessalonica, there seemed to be such success in spreading of the gospel amongst the Jews, though, that jealousy reared its ugly head. But those opposed to them could not even find enough Jews to form a decent-sized mob. Verses 5 and 6 of chapter 17. But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And coming upon the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. And when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some of the brethren before the city authorities, shouting, now listen to this, these men who have upset the world have come here also. It is clear in all times that the adversary so motivates enemies of the truth as to use any means to attack the message, even when those who truly oppose the truth are in short supply. Recruitment of any so disposed to mischief and even violence can be employed by him. The charges that Paul was, or maybe even we will be at the end of this age, be accused of something that was totally outlandish, upset the world and turned the world upside down. Please, they were just witnessing the gospel of Jesus. But the adversary, we have to remember, will employ any method he can find to inhibit the church, especially at the end of the age. Seeing the dangers, however, the local brethren immediately arranged for Paul and Silas to leave under cover of darkness and head down the road a relatively short distance to Berea. The continued experience with those opposed to the truth did not change Paul's approach, though. Upon entry to Berea, they proceeded to the synagogue and began preaching the truth. Berea seems to have an exceptional number of Jewish converts. The reputation for their diligence in searching the scriptures daily seemingly applies not to the whole church at Berea, but as we read critically verses 11 and 12, this compliment is assigned mainly to the Jewish converts separate from the Gentiles, mentioned in verse 12, verse 11. Now they were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica and received the word with great eagerness, establishing the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Many of them, that being the Jews, therefore believed, along with a number of prominent Greek women and men. It appears that things would have gone rather smooth in this city as well, had not word got back to Thessalonica that Paul and the brethren were having even more success in this town. Agitators were recruited again in Thessalonica and brought to Berea to stir up more problems for the spread of the message there. The brethren in Berea were determined to spare Paul another experience in prison, and so they got him to the coast and sent him via ship, and sent him via ship to Athens. Silas and Timothy apparently stayed behind in Berea to assist and encourage the brethren while Paul was in transit. Verses 17 through 34 of this chapter contain the account of Paul's visit to Athens. Upon his arrival, Paul immediately sent word for Silas and Timothy to meet him there, even though he would meet them ultimately in Corinth. Even though the Grecian Empire had been overrun by Rome centuries earlier, the renown of Greek civilization, and that was well past its peak at this time, it was still the city of Athens, an impressive city. Brother Russell describes it during Paul's visit as the center of the world's culture, intelligence, and worldly wisdom. Also the capital of science, art, theology, and schools. The home of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Despite the grand buildings, some in ruins, it is clear that from the scriptures that Paul was still less than impressed, despite his formal education, which likely had heaped praises upon this civilization. Verse 16. Now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was beholding the city full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. From the synagogue to the marketplace, Paul would talk to anyone who would listen to him concerning the truth. As a result, some of the modern philosophers of the day wished to understand more of what Paul was preaching. In the verse 18 of the 17th chapter, they call him a proclaimer of strange deities, and they brought him to Areopagus, which in verse 19 and 22 is also referred to as Mars Hill. This is where great philosophical discussions of the day were debated before the Athenian council. And although the scriptures do not seem to emphasize the import of Paul getting to speak here, Brother Russell puts it in concise perspective in reprint 31:38. And let me just quote you a couple of sentences here. That the Apostle Paul, without letters of introduction, without political or other influence serving as such, should succeed in a few days in obtaining an invitation to address this august body of men indicates clearly that he was a man of remarkable talent as well as learning. These natural qualities in him were reinforced by the spirit of a sound mind, the spirit of the Lord, the spirit of divine revelation, the true gospel. It is said that this council had the power to sentence to death anyone who should attempt to set forth strange gods in Athens. And hence the apostles' hearing before them was probably more or less in the nature of a trial for life. Because he had been preaching Jesus and an unheard of God amongst the Athenians up to this time, as well as preaching the resurrection, which was a concept in general foreign to them as well. Paul's brilliant piece of reasoning and oratory, it's seemingly poorly translated in the King James Version, where it might appear that Paul was actually mocking his audience. But Brother Russell gives a paraphrase of this speech in reprint 31:39. I suggest you read that. We won't have time to go over it. It's excellent. But it really gives you the better feeling of this than reading it in the scriptures. Reprint 31:39. So impressed were many of the council that there was not only no mention of prosecution of this strange God's violation, but they indicated in verse 32 that a return invitation to Paul was likely, and others followed him out of this presentation with more inquiries. Thus ends the record we have of the events in Athens. Paul's next journey is about 40 miles to the west to Corinth, and we move to the 18th chapter of Acts. Although there seemed to be some interest in Athens, Paul perceived that the interest there was mainly detached intellectual pursuit. Such has been the history in the gospel age that not many learned, wise, or wealthy of the world are even called or even seek after the Lord. Although in Corinth has a reputation of being less moral and sophisticated than Athens, but as a consequence, Paul perceived that Corinth would thus be a more fertile field for the growth of an ecclesia. Silas and Timothy are apparently able to finally catch up to Paul here in Corinth. Even though here Paul focused on his ministry to the Jews, it seems like the Jews almost unanimously rejected the message, and not with polite or respectful words. There were several incidents in Corinth, but we will only have time to summarize one briefly. Again, after Paul seemingly rejects the Jews for rejecting the gospel, They would later bring Paul up on charges before the local council of, and the charges were proselytizing Jews. The Lord promised Paul directly that he had many people in the city, and sure enough, the council, the chief of council, Gallio, was one of them, and he perceived this religious squabble to be not worthy of his time in adjudicating it, and effectively tossed the case out of court. The Lord had people there that kept Paul safe. Verse 18 tells us that Paul remained many days after this incident. So it's clear he wasn't driven out of Corinth, but instead left on his own timetable, probably somewhere around the year AD 56. The last three cities mentioned on Paul's second missionary journey are contained in the last four scriptures of this journey, verses 19 through 22, which again, we won't have time to read. But let's just summarize by saying they were Ephesus, Caesarea, and finally he returns to the starting city in Antioch in Syria. The whole excursion may have taken approximately 4 years from AD 52 to AD 56. It was close to 1,000 miles over land from Antioch to Corinth, and about another 750 miles from Corinth home, most of that via the sea. He was back at the nearest thing he had to a home city, that being in Antioch, and there he would compose his letter to the Galatians. We no doubt that he felt all that much more comfortable or relieved being back in Antioch, because it would only be less than a year before he would be on the road again on his third missionary journey.